and I'm actually doing a piece while I'm here. I'm researching a piece.
What's it going to be
on
about?
On AIDS.
On AIDS?
Touchy subject. The panic has only just hit England.
No, I was going to say, it's becoming old hat here.
Yeah.
Are you
going to
shed some new light on AIDS?
Well, all I'm going to try and do is accelerate the process by which, you know, it'll be slightly understood and not be such a panic subject in England. We're at the stage you were a few years back, two, maybe 3 years back, where, you know, gay people are getting kicked out of clubs and pubs and so on. No one will go near them, no one will give blood, let alone receive it, you know. Prince Charles had to go and give blood on television and with lots of photographers present to reassure the nation that this wasn't a dangerous thing to do. The junior health minister had to shake an AIDS victim by the hand, you know, and we're in the early stages of panic. Actually, I came here thinking, now what's it like 2 years after the panic? And the answer is panic. It still seems, or at least, you know, severe crisis.
Well, a few years ago, my wife, who was then doing clinical research at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan, came home and she said, I had just accidentally injected myself with a needle that had been used on an AIDS patient we were doing research with, and she was shaking. I mean, and she was. And I said, "What's the matter? Calm down." I mean, you get an antidote for it. Just relax, you know. What you get? And then she realized that I had no idea about what AIDS was, and I didn't.
No, you didn't.
I had never heard of it. I knew she was working on something called AIDS, but I had never read a piece about it in the paper. I'd never seen anything on television or anything on the radio, and I had no idea that it was as lethal a disease as it turns out to have been.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you. I was reading Money almost in tandem with Dick Francis' new book, because he's coming in later this afternoon, and matter of fact, I would read Money for a while, and then I would put it aside and pick up Proof. And obviously, I cannot imagine two completely different types of books. I found, I don't know if this is correct, I found some echoes of Henry Miller in Money. Not necessarily sexually, but in the writing style. Maybe I'm off a little bit, but did you have any Henry Miller influence in your writing style?
I think I may well have done years ago, but I haven't looked at him since I was a teenager and was found hunched over it with all my friends. No, I think such influences as I have are more recent, and though American. I mean, there is definitely an American strain in that book.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a year over here when I was a kid and have come here quite a lot throughout my 20s. And the novelists I read are American novelists.
You were here when your father was teaching at
Princeton. That's right.
So you were, how old were you at that time?
I was 10. But I think a lot of stuff comes in and is bedded down on a subconscious or subliminal level. And when I came to write about America, having always, my previous novels are all firmly set in London, it was quite a jump. And I think without that year of unconsciously listening to Americans, for instance, I might not have been able to do it.
Chris, Princeton is somewhat isolated from the mainstream, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But we lived in a suburban bungalow, you know, just like everyone else there. But you just get American mores and values and winsomenesses.
Whatever they are.
Whatever they are. But they sink in, and then that, when you come to reproduce them, you have this little bedding of, you're not going to go too far wrong. A lot of transatlantic attempts to render speech often fall horribly flat or seem perfunctory or corny. And I hope I avoided any of that.
You spent your younger life growing up outside of this year in Princeton in London, is that correct?
Yeah, I had a year in Spain as well. And I was in Wales for a while. Mostly, and I was taught in Cambridge as well. But from the age of about 14 on, I lived in London.
As you were growing up, did you have an awareness of the kind of work that your father did?
Well, I knew he was a writer, but as far as I knew, he could have been writing Dick Francis novels or science fiction novels or even romantic novels. I just had no idea what genre he was engaged in. Then when I did read him when I was about 18, I recognized that he was writing mainstream novels, which is
He also wrote at least one James Bond, as I recall.
He wrote a James Bond novel, and in fact he likes to flit around among the genres. He's written a sort of science fiction novel. He's written a classic sort of 1920s detective novel. But then I realized that actually the voice I found in the novels was not too distant from the voice I heard over the dinner table, that he was writing about the here and now.
What did you study in college?
English.
At what point in your life did you have some idea that you wanted to put words on the paper?
Very early on, before I ever did try and put words on the paper. When I was about 13, 14, I just had an inkling that this is what I would like to do. And this didn't mean that I did, as some budding writers do, immediately write 8 plays and 6 epic poems or anything. I kept my mouth shut, but my eyes open in that everything that happened to me, I often wondered how you would do this in a book. You know? You have a sort of a third eye, which is always on the lookout for something that might be used. It's quite a cool attitude to experience, in fact. You can't ever be totally wholehearted, because you're always one step back and thinking about the shape of incidents that happen to you.
You've been able to pull it off, but wasn't it scary as you started out writing, knowing that your father was also doing this in a very successful way? There are, I've talked to some other offspring of writers who went ahead and did it with some degree of success. Jonathan Fast, who was the son of Howard Fast, Susan Cheever, daughter of John Cheever. But isn't it scary? Say, gosh, how can I walk in those, as I think Robert Lowell put it about his father, those dinosaur tracks?
Yes. Well, actually, I have to admit, I sort of cheerfully admit that it never bothered me. And that it's very nice to have sympathy for and people saying how tough it must have been. But actually, it was, if anything, just a little bit easier starting out, I think. Also, my father he did the right thing out of pure indolence, I'm sure, of not encouraging me at all. So he hardly knew I was up to anything until I gave him the proofs of my first novel. I've known many sons of writers who've been prematurely encouraged by their writing fathers. And this is when a father says to his son, you're very good, you know, you ought to stick at this, why don't you try this or that, and write a novel, write a short story. When a father does that to his child, he's in fact making quite a complicated promise. He's saying, in effect, you can have my life, you can be me. But of course, literary talent is actually not often transmitted. There are very, very few cases of it. Perhaps Mrs. Trollope and Trollope are the only at all significant ones. So it's very unlikely that the son is going to be any good. Not the case with musical talent, for instance. So I think, you know, if I am some good, and my father is some good or better, it's a very lucky accident and was really the result of non-interference rather than...
When you took that proof to your father for that first book and he read it, did you ask him to offer specific advice?
Certainly not advice. Actually, I think it's pretty well the only novel of mine that he's been able to read to the end. He doesn't really like modern prose. He likes Dick Francis. Dick Francis is his favorite living author. My father once said to me, I'm not going to read any more novels that don't begin with the sentence, a shot rang up. He says it's too much like hard work, you know. He likes thrillers. He reads a lot of poetry, on the other hand. Again, not much modern poetry. But he's, as he would admit, he's sort of, his tastes are slightly fossilized. He thinks it's all gone wrong. He thinks it's all gone to hell in the last century, starting with Joyce. It's got too fancy. It's got too self-regarding. And I am on the fancy self-regarding wing of writing, I guess, a bit, although I hope I'm still got, you know, interesting characters and a certain amount of action and incident to tempt people along. And I think he just gets irritated by my kind of writing.
So what does he say?
He doesn't say anything.
Enough, Martin? Enough already?
He thinks I know what I'm up to. And many of his friends like my stuff. But I proudly give him a new copy of the book of mine, and then I go around 2 weeks later, and every corner of every page up to page 30 has been at some point bent over. And then I go around another 2 weeks later, and he's maybe got up to page 50, and every corner of every page. So it's like a sort of concertina, the book, by this time. And then I go around another 2 weeks later, and it's stopped. So I don't push him about it. I've given up pushing him about it.
Well, it was a wonderful opportunity for me to study the contrast in Money and in Proof. Obviously, here is Proof is simply written. It's a novel of action. It's a murder mystery. Money, of course, is a much more complex book literarily, and it is one that you cannot read in the same way that you can read a Dick Francis. For Dick Francis, you read to be entertained, and you read it fast. Money, I can't do that. I would read through Proof, and one thing, Proof is a lot smaller book than it appears. It's about 10 lines on the page shorter than yours, and the paper is very, very thick. Even though it lists here at 333 pages, Proof is actually probably less than 200 pages.
Really? It looks like a doorstop, that book.
Yeah, well, Petnam wanted to package it in such a way as to make it look like this is something very special. They didn't have to do that with Money, because Money is the kind of book that cannot be hurried, because you have to read it carefully, and you have to look for the ideas and look at the characterizations, which are certainly more complex than we can find with Dick Francis. So I found myself, if I put down Proof and began to pick up Money, I would still read at the same pace. And I might read several paragraphs and I'd say, wait, stop, I'm missing everything. And I would have to back up and start over again. So a reader cannot be hurried when he reads Money.
I think readers do tend to read a little fast, whatever they're reading. They tend to want to get to the end and on to the next thing. And I find myself almost consciously trapping them by not giving them, by inserting worrying clues that things are not quite as they seem. And really all I'm saying in the margin is slow down.
They have no choice. If they don't slow down, they're not going to get it. Your hero, John Self, right? John Self. It is not a very likable character. He's a patron of pornography, of prostitutes, of topless bars. He's an alcohol abuser. Have you known people like that? How did you develop this character?
Well, I might as well come right out and say that when you've got a big first-person novel, you couldn't write it without having an element of the character in yourself. But I hasten to add that you take this tiny little nugget of sinfulness and then exaggerate it, and in my case comically exaggerate it. My character has a very bad time trying to have a good time all the time. That's sort of his trap, and also his energy. I think you know, in your 20s and early 30s, you have a taste of all kinds of lives. And certainly for a novelist, it pays you to develop these in your mind and just wonder if that was the only bit of your character. You know, what would it be like then? Whether it be the envious the generous side. it's true that John Self is an amalgam of specifically 20th century sins. He is, you know, horribly overstimulated sort of character. And in another sense, he's almost like an animal in that he has no cultural padding of any kind. And yet here he is propelled into a very fast-lane, instant gratification kind of life, which you know, would, as these things always do, tend to press the self-destruct button in the end.
Mm-hmm. You said there are nuggets of yourself in John Self, and yet you make of yourself a character in Money, and you portray yourself in Money as one who's very solid, reasonable, intelligent. You describe your apartment in Money. Seems very ordinary, much restraint. There's no over-purchasing of commodities. As I recall, you had no, or the Martin Amis in the book has no videotape recorder. It keeps a very plain, cloistered life, it's so it appears. What, did you deliberately then create two perspectives of yourself?
Yes, deliberately is... It's never quite how it seems when you're writing. Nothing you ever do seems quite deliberate until they're very, until you're sort of polishing a novel rather than writing it. I am a minor character in that novel. In all my previous novels, I've always had these edgy narrators who are, in a sense, trying to worm their way onto center stage. In this book, the real motive, in as much as it was a motive, was that John Self is getting screwed around by everyone in the novel. He's being duped. He's being taken for a ride. He's being put through. He's being punished by characters for various neurotic reasons. And I, whenever I write a novel, I always think, what am I up to? Why am I doing these terrible things to my characters? Why do I make them so unattractive or so ill-favored or ignorant? So I thought it was high time that I actually came on and made my case clear. So I do, the Martin Amis character often confronts the John Self character and tells him what's going on. Not straightforwardly, but ambiguously. But of course, John Self being John Self, he's always wondering about his car or his girlfriend or his bank balance, and he never really takes the clues that are offered him.
Brazen of you to put Martin Amis in the book by name, isn't it?
It felt very brazen, but actually I think it reads okay, and I think it provides a sort of balance in the book. I think it has been done once or twice before. I think Kurt Vonnegut in Breakfast of Champions did it rather nicely. But again, I'm a minor character. I'm not a sort of pivotal character. So it's just another layer, really. It's not the sort of crucial confrontation of the book.
There are a number of scenes I really liked in Money. One that I particularly liked was the friend of John Self. I think his name is Alec.
Alec.
It was in the prison scene where John Self went to visit Alec in prison, and before I think he was actually sent up. It was kind of a temporary holding pen, was it, or was that actually?
He was the first time he's in on bail in Brixton, which is the sort of remand prison.
Yeah.
And the second time later on, he's in Pentonville, which is where you go when you've been actually sent down.
And in Brixton, he was treated quite nicely, as I recall, and was able to make friends with everybody, but that changed when he went up to the prison to serve his hard time.
Right, but Alec Llewellyn, who's a sort of upper-class desperado, as opposed to a working-class one like John Self, points out an interesting thing that I've had confirmed many times, is that the class system is absolutely intact in England in prison. It's the only place where it still works. If you go to prison in England and you talk in an educated voice, they treat you like royalty. You think you'd get beaten up and sort of given a really bad time, but in fact they all adore you. And even the sort of governor comes down and sort of hangs out with you and sort of shoots the breeze with you. And I thought that was a nice little mirror to the rest of society, where of course the class system, while still prevalent, is under constant attack and is being redistributed. I mean, money is being redistributed. There's such a thing now in England, I'm sure it exists here in other forms, called downward mobility, where people whose parents, say, had private incomes and right back many generations that had, you know, big houses in the country and lots of servants, all that's been eroded by various things, and now these almost titled people are postmen and you know, work in zoos and so on. It's quite a common thing.
Speaking of zoos, you do paint a contrast between London and New York. And London seems a little more bucolic than New York. But in New York is rougher and more violent. But then, of course, you have John Self is going to topless bars and 42nd Street and the worst sections of Broadway. And if you put him in that environment, it's going to seem as though I've lived in New York for 18 years, and I rarely go into the Times Square area simply because it's offensive. But if you want to find a quieter, more level place to go, you can certainly find it in New York on a par with that of London. And I just kind of wondered about that. Why you were a little rough on the big town.
If as a writer you want to see what's going on not only in a city but in a time span, it wouldn't be much good hanging around on Madison Avenue and 75th Street.
Looking at antique shops.
Yeah, you'd see plenty, but you wouldn't see the violent, and I mean violent, not physical violence, but the graphic deformities that a big city in the 1980s can produce. Also, John Self would naturally go to the area where he felt most at home, and that would tend to be Times Square. And on the other hand, additionally, Times Square is there, whether one goes there or not, and says a very great deal about New York. But he does. I mean, he gets about New York. He goes to Columbia. He goes to the Village. He's on the Upper East Side.
He walks up Amsterdam Avenue, passes my house. Did your father get through money?
No. He made it to page 65, I think, and then it sort of flopped out.
Well, it's too bad that John Self did the things he did, but he really had it coming, didn't he?
He had it coming, and actually I think, although he ends up rather distressed at the end of the novel, it still seems to me a happy ending, because the only way that John Self could ever get on with money is not to have any. Then he can't afford his vices. You know? And it's been said, I think, by maybe Dorothy Parker, maybe Shaw, that what you end up with is your virtues, because all the other stuff is too ridiculous. And I think he learns that lesson by the end.
Well, Martin Amis, the book here in the States has certainly received respectful reviews, and it was an accomplishment, and I congratulate you on the book, and I'm delighted that you were able to come in and spend a short amount of time with me, and I hope that I'll have a chance to read more of Martin Amis and have you come back, and next time you're in the States, we can do this again if it wasn't too painful.
It wasn't at all painful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.